Go behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, Scott.
Hey, Ben.
Did you hear that?
I did.
Can you hear that? What does it sound like?
Pinging?
Yeah, that would be radar.
Oh, very good.
Thanks to the magic of our super producer, Liz, today, and the fact that we're on the internet, no one can actually see us, we very well may be in a submarine.
We're broadcasting live from a submarine.
Live from a submarine.
No, I'm lying.
I mean, recorded in front of a live submarine audience.
Yeah, that's right. Of course we're not. We're lying.
We're sort of lying.
Yeah, sort of.
We can neither confirm nor deny.
You would really like to be on a submarine, though, wouldn't you?
Yes.
You found out that, through research, you like this a lot, right?
Yes. Yes, sir. Indeed.
What's so intriguing?
Okay, Scott. Let me just give you the quick and dirty. Here's what's intriguing. I don't want to put any spoilers out for what people are going to find out about in the course of this episode.
Okay, so you're going to tease us.
I want people to listen. I don't want people to just go, you just told me the end.
Tempt them into listening to the end then.
Well, let's try. Let's see if we can paint a picture of one of my favorite vehicles in the world.
Okay. Without giving anything away.
Right, because the whole stealth and secrecy is like part of the whole shebang, man.
Understood.
All right, so submarine, obviously we can look at the etymology of that. Underwater. Not that crazy.
Easy enough.
However, in practice, this becomes tremendously complicated, obscenely dangerous, and almost unbelievably cool when it works. Because we're talking about vehicles that for decades could slip undetected through the most heavily protected water, could achieve feats in naval warfare that would be science fiction to people before submarines existed. But, look at me. I'm blathering on about that. And you're our historian today, right, Scott?
Maybe.
Maybe?
Maybe. Yeah, I'll blather on for a little while myself here.
Did you see Hunt for Red October?
I did.
I'm just checking.
Hold on. Of course I did. Yeah. I think it's part of the contract.
Yeah.
Have to. I guess, you know what? You know what's – this is pretty interesting, I thought.
What's that?
Guess who this goes all the way back to. You know already, don't
yeah.
you? I can tell just by the look on your face. Go ahead and say it.
All right. And this goes way back to an Italian man that you may have heard of before, not Silvio Berlusconi, or however you pronounce his last name. Sorry, Silvio. But our very own hometown favorite of car stuff, Leonardo
da Vinci. That's right. Yeah, it goes all the way back to Da Vinci. Mm-hmm. So of course, this is one of those ones where he sketched, and it never really came to reality. Kind of like the helicopter and, the parachute and other things like that.
The car.
But they found sketches for a submarine in his books. Mm-hmm. And remember, he's around 1500, mm-hmm. early 1500s. Mm-hmm. And he called it a ship to sink another ship, which, I mean, that was really the only purpose of the submarine. Is it, why else would you want to travel underwater? It's a way to deliver a deadly blow to another ship.
Right.
I read somewhere, and I don't have my note in front of me here, but I read somewhere that he was kind of upset by his own thoughts on this. Like, he had sketched some other war devices, and he felt kind of guilty about them.
Yeah.
Saying that, why would I want to design something that could bring harm to someone else? He was mostly in it for the good and wanted to, create stuff that, crazy flying machines and, mm-hmm. That was kind of
a moral quandary.
I guess an impure thought to him is to create a ship that could sink another ship where there were men on board at the time. So he felt bad about that. Now, same century, in 1578, someone named William Bourne, who was a British mathematician, he drew plans for another submarine, which is a little bit more modern in appearance. Mm-hmm. Same idea, but it was never built. Again, just drawn up, but again, this mathematician decided, this would be a good idea still. Later, and this is not until 1620, someone named Cornelius van Drebbel. Good name, huh?
Distinctive name,
Cornelius.
Yeah.
Sometimes I say that's what the C in my middle name stands for, Cornelius.
I will totally back you up on
Scott
that.
Scott Cornelius Benjamin.
That's classy.
Or Cookie.
Cornelius.
I'm okay. Voting. Cornelius, yeah. He's a Dutch inventor, and he built a sub. He finally built a sub in 1620. So this is really the first sub that was ever built. And really what it was is this is kind of funny. It's picture a rowboat that's wrapped in watertight leather.
Okay,
so it's encased in watertight leather. And this is top and bottom. You know, of course, it's just completely wrapped in it. It had air tubes that went to the surface via floats, so they were held on top of the water, these air intakes.
Okay.
And he made his first trip on the Thames River with 12 oarsmen because they didn't have any kind of propulsion system.
So they had to have underwater rowers?
They had underwater rowers. They had people with oars sticking out, you know, like best thing I can remember is like the slave ships that you see people rowing in.
Like, the galleys.
Yeah, exactly. He had 12, he had 12 men with him, and they went under for 3 hours, which is pretty good.
Which, they could not have been that far under the surface of the water if they didn't have a pump mechanism.
I don't think it wasn't fully submersed, I think. I think it was just under. I don't know, as far as fully, maybe, but, you know, they've got these air tubes that go to the shore still, or rather the surface. By the time we get to the revolution here in 1776, someone named David Bushnell built something called the Turtle.
The Toidle.
Yeah. And really, this is just a one-man wooden submarine. This looks like a barrel when you see it.
Yeah, it almost looks like a diving bell.
You've seen this then?
Yeah, we've seen some.
Completely mechanical. Mm-hmm. There's nothing electrical about it, of course. It looks terrifying to be in, I think.
I would have to be paid. I would have to be paid to go under.
Really? Yeah, I think I would too.
The gears were grinding. I was like, for free? No.
Yeah, I know. Well, it had all these hand-operated devices. I mean, hand-turned propellers. And, of course, the rudders and everything were foot-driven. He's sitting on a wooden bench inside this thing. And the reason they called it the Turtle is because it looked like two turtle shells attached together. It didn't have a perfectly round shape or anything like that.
Right.
But very, very simple design, really, and, complex for its time. But in the war, it was actually viewed as something that was unnecessary and troublesome at the time because it wasn't really that effective. I mean, they found that the design is effective to get to the ships. That the idea behind this thing was to deliver explosives, attach them to a ship, and then leave.
Okay.
And what happened was it was able to sneak up on the ships because no one had ever seen anything like this. So it did sneak up, you know, under the cover of night, that type of thing. You know, it's just maybe the periscope sticking up in an airline, of course. Mm-hmm. It was able to deliver the explosives, but I guess the explosives were not successful. So that was why it was deemed a failure. And you could imagine how, you know, terrifying that must be, sneaking up on a ship in this little wooden crate type thing.
Yeah.
Barrel, trying to attach an explosive device. That must have been
and then trying to get
spooky.
Out.
Yeah, and you're doing this all at night, too. And then trying to get out on time because you had to attach it and then get the heck out of there. You know, with this hand driven propeller before the thing went off. Had to have been terrifying. And then in the 1890s, really came about the first true submarines. What we would recognize as a submarine, I guess.
Okay.
So you're talking about the metal hull vehicles that they use. They're finally able to use steam engines because that was being used on land as well, and so they knew the technology and that it would work. Mm-hmm. So they used steam engines when they were on the surface, and then when they were below the surface, they used electric motors.
Electric motors.
Electric motors. That's right. Because that's remember we talked about this. Yeah. They had electric cars at the time as well. So,
sure.
Seems like new technology, but it's not. It's old.
Nope.
Old technology. And at the same time, around the 1890s, that's when they started first using torpedoes. So they were able to project the explosives were able to shoot them towards the target. Now they had, you know, guidance problems and things like that to deal with, but they had tiny electric motors that drove these things and, they were relatively successful.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
that's the, around the 1890s, that's when you first saw the first true submarines. I don't know, boy, we can go, there's a lot of different directions. They were used in World War I.
Right.
Yeah. Relatively ineffective. The technology just wasn't there yet at this point.
And very, very dangerous.
Yeah.
Oh, this God. Is something where we discovered we being the human species, not you and me.
Oh, yeah.
We, the human species, discovered the concept of an idea and kept trying to do it, but we learned through trial and terrible error.
Unfortunately, this continues right through today.
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, we can talk about that in a moment, but you know, World War One, they just weren't that advanced. They just didn't quite have the technology that they needed to be, you know, as stealth as they needed to be, and they were easily found, and you know, there's a lot of trouble for them. They didn't have the backup systems in place either for saving the crew. You know, if it was to go down, that was it.
Yeah.
They didn't have the way of
evacuating.
Exactly. They just didn't have the same technologies available now. In World War II, they had pretty much refined to the point where they were in really good shape. They knew what they were doing at this point. Not just us, of course. The Germans had
the U-boats
exactly. And the U-boats, you know what? I'll be honest. I didn't know a whole lot about U-boats until I started reading about them. But I did find out that you know they were. I mean, I just didn't know the whole background of them, and that they were essentially really just a more boat could go underwater as part of a way to evade.
Yes.
I don't know why I didn't know much about these up until this point, but I just didn't.
Well, we tend to, in popular stories, you know, we tend to focus on the U-boat's stealth capabilities.
Mm-hmm.
So that I think the average person would probably think it was entirely a submarine.
Well, I guess they were super, you know, real powerful, real deadly machines.
Yeah.
And they had this ability to go underwater. It's a boat, really, that it works great on the surface, works so-so underwater.
Mm-hmm.
But they were, I guess they were able to escape any kind of confrontation because they had great speed on the surface. Of course, they were heavily armed. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, really extremely heavily armed. They were very stealth because they could dive if needed to, but they couldn't stand there for very long. They weren't, they just weren't as capable as the modern subs that we see now. Trying to think of some other, the benefits of them.
Let's see. They were able to. Well, I guess it all goes back to that. That their superpower was their speed and their evasive ability.
Well, yeah, they were extremely maneuverable.
Yeah.
That's another thing. So, they were just slippery boats.
Kind
I'll
of
tell
a
you
big
that.
Deal. Slippery
yeah, they
boats.
Were,
yeah.
They were a big deal at the time. That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. So, boy, now
so
we're
here
getting,
we are.
Now here we're getting to your favorite part.
We are.
Yes, right. Yeah, the nuclear subs.
Yes. Oh, man, nuclear subs. Okay, wait. I'm very excited.
Okay.
But before we go into that, Scott, people will notice with the history of these things, it's sort of a history punctuated by incredible setbacks, human tragedy,
mm-hmm.
Both when they worked successfully attacking other ships and when they unfortunately went down
mm-hmm.
with all the crew. And we're talking about explosions from torpedoes. We're talking about structural imperfections, you know, especially when you get into the higher pressure underwater.
Deep sea dives, yeah.
Yeah. So
and you run into things like crevices and mountains and mm-hmm. other ships.
Other ships, yeah. Or mines.
Mm-hmm.
So really the question that one would logically ask after this is, why do we keep messing with these things? What's the point of submarines, you know? And the point of submarines, they have tremendous potential for destruction. They also have tremendous potential to give information in places where even today we would have a difficult time gathering information via satellite or something like that. So before we get to what is, again, obviously my favorite part of this podcast, let's talk a little bit about how submarines in general work.
Okay, so the mechanics of it.
Yeah, just the mechanics.
Sure.
Just the mechanics. All right, so pop quiz, Scott. What's the basic difference between a submarine and a ship?
Oh, you know ship stays on the surface. Submarine can go – can do both.
Hole in one. You win the prize and the game show is over. But here's how these things can actually work. And this is from our article, How Submarines Work, which you can find on the website. The way that the submarine sinks is – or the way it floats is that the weight of the water it displaces is equal to the weight of the actual vessel. And so this makes a force called the buoyant force, which, of course, buoyancy means that it pushes it.
Keeps you right on the surface.
Keeps you right on the surface.
Okay.
So the submarine has to get over this buoyant force and able to submerge itself. So it has these ballast tanks, just like another ship would have, right? And then it has these extra tanks called trim tanks. Now, these can be filled with water or air, and if you go to the article, you'll see an awesome animation.
Mm-hmm.
And I,
simple with valves and, you know, the airflow and everything.
Right, right. Largely mechanical.
Yeah.
And so as the submarine dives, the ballast tanks get flooded with water, and the air that was already in the tanks is vented from the submarine until the vessel's density is greater than the water surrounding it. So it begins to get what we call negative buoyancy, pushing it down. So it sinks. And so they still keep air on the submarine, of course, because people breathe even underwater.
Yeah.
That's in theory, right?
Not Aquaman.
Right. And they not Aquaman.
Oh, well.
Aquaman.
Yeah.
That poor guy. Can you imagine being in the Justice League?
Sorry, I threw that in there.
He talks to fish, Scott. Yeah. That's his power. He talks to fish.
Superpower.
Well, he breathes underwater. All right, so submarines also, they control this sinking by using those small wing-looking things on the body of the sub are called hydroplanes. So they control, of course, the angle of the dive. And when the when they're underwater, they still have to adjust to make sure that they stay level, right? Because it's very
You don't want to just keep sinking. That's no good.
Or right.
Rising, you know, sinking and rising. Sinking,
yeah, you
rising.
Don't want to just hope that people on the surface aren't looking.
Yeah, exactly.
As you try to.
Yeah, good point.
It'd be like me learning stick, man. You should have been there. It was a nasty afternoon. But so when. So when we use this this ballast technology, which is, again, ballast or something that you see in ships that only stay on the surface, and helps maintain the level. So we're just taking that to a further degree. And we've figured out how to do that pretty much, I don't want to say perfectly, but much better than any time in the past. And now we're at a situation where if it's not broke, don't fix it. People know how to build submarines that can surface and sink reliably. And luckily for hundreds of people, we actually figure out how to keep folks alive while they're doing that. Right, right. Because human, it's
most
not,
important. Yeah, because I've heard even recently, it seems like we've heard of subs that are stuck on the bottom and they can get messages back and forth and they just can't get to them. They're too deep.
Yes.
I know we've heard that in the past.
Yes, sir.
So there's some bad news, you know, bad stuff that's been going on with that. You know what? It's been a few years since I've heard anything like that happen, but I've also heard of some private individuals, you know, when they try to make these recreational subs.
Right. Yeah.
I remember clearly I went to a boat show in Detroit when I was young, and we saw a recreational sub that a young startup guy was trying to develop this submarine for weekend type use in the lakes. And, you know, of course those subs are different. They have big windows, you know, rounded windows, a lot of, you know, viewing is what you're there for. You're not
right.
just going underwater to serve a mission or something. You want to go under and see around. So you had this, this relatively small, like a 2-man sub, maybe 3-man sub. And it probably wasn't more than a year later that we heard that he was killed in testing for this thing. Now,
this
he's trying to sell it at the boat show. We talked to him for a while, you know, just kind of interested in what's going on. And then the next summer, I guess, he died in testing this thing in the lakes. So there's still accidents that happen. I mean, it's not, you know, it's not exactly a precise science at this point. You know,
right.
The military does it right, of course. They know what they're doing. But there's always something that can go wrong. So, you know, they've got all these backup systems, and there's a lot of redundancy in the safety of these things.
Yes, there has to be, and we learned that the hard way.
Yeah.
So when we think of – in our article, when we think of the problems with life support in what's essentially a closed environment, a sealed system, until from the time it leaves the surface to the time it returns. So what we have to do for the people there, we have to make sure that they can breathe and that they can actually get fresh water. Let's just skip food and let's worry more about the temperature. You know what? Also, let's skip the psychological effects.
Oh, yeah.
I think cabin fever might be
sure
something for, you know, not quite the scope
have
of
you,
our
have
show.
Have you ever toured a sub?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh, are they tight? They're just cramped
hallway
spaces.
Hallway after tiny hallway.
I know. You're ducking the whole way through. I'm not very tall. You have to duck all the way through every doorway, of course. And a lot of times you're dodging pipes and valves. And it's really cramped quarters. And I can't imagine knowing that you're, 10,000 feet down or whatever. It's got to be unbelievable just psychology that goes into something like
that. Yeah, there've got to be tests for claustrophobia.
Oh, yeah. I don't know how long the test would have to be, though, because, I mean, these can stay under a long, long time.
Yes. And, oh gosh, okay. I'm having a hard time not getting to that.
Oh.
All right, so riddle me this. We're in a place where there's no new air coming in. How are we going to let people continue to breathe?
Yeah, we need fresh air all the time, right?
Yes.
Because really, they're just going to breathe out carbon dioxide, right?
Right. Luckily, we have scrubbers installed in subs, and what they do is they use soda lime, sodium hydroxide, and calcium hydroxide to actually trap the carbon dioxide that's just floating around in the air and remove it from that air. So we have a way to clean it.
But then how do you introduce new oxygen?
Yeah. Yes. We supply that either from pressurized oxygen tanks or, and get this is kind of space age, an oxygen generator. And that uses electrolysis of water to create oxygen.
Very cool.
Yeah, but, you know, keep in mind, of course, that the air we breathe up here is mostly nitrogen, like 78%, 80% nitrogen,
sure,
20% oxygen.
So are they monitoring that all the time? Are they they're adjusting?
Constantly.
Okay, cool.
And, you know, keep in mind also that at these depths, you know, you've heard of the bends that you can get from diving too deep unprotected.
Sure, and then surfacing too fast, is that right?
Yeah. So we also have to make sure that we maintain cabin pressure and temperature. So the temperature around a submarine is usually like 39 degrees or 4 degrees Celsius, Scott.
Oh, very good.
Yeah.
Very good. See, that's your position here. Your conversions, yeah.
Oh, gosh. I've
good
only
work.
Done the one.
Good work.
I'm going to have a new job by the next time I do this. So there are problems. In short, we're still addressing some of those, but nuclear submarines are vital. Oh, excuse me, I spoiled it. Submarines are a very, very important part of modern international affairs.
Yeah, you mentioned something that I was reading on this too, and you mentioned fresh water.
Yes, sir.
So you're here. You are 10,000 feet under the ocean.
Not a drop.
Not a drop of water that you can drink. That's right. And how do you get fresh water down there?
What?
I mean, other than like carrying a gallon of it yourself, and that's what you drink.
Well, you know, we can distill fresh water from seawater.
Okay.
We can do that, of course, since most people, or I think about a billion people in the world, don't have access to clean water because that distillation process is just not efficient on a huge scale.
Mm-hmm.
But when you've got a submarine full of thirsty people who need to do important things, you can use a distillation plant. It heats the seawater to vapor, right? So that removes a lot of the salt,
mm-hmm.
or removes all the salt, I think. And
I would hope so.
Yeah, I would hope so. And then it cools it into a collecting tank of fresh water. So that's basically the age-old method of distilling.
And I read how many gallons that takes a day, typical sub. This is between 10 and 40,000 gallons of water a day, fresh water.
Really?
Yeah, it says between 10 and 40,000 gallons per day is used on a submarine. And that's mostly for cooling the equipment, cooling the engines, cooling anything that's going to generate heat down there.
I'm such a jerk. I was like, do they have a pool?
No. No, it's 10 to 40,000 gallons a day.
Wow.
That's mostly for cooling. Mm-hmm. The rest of it is used for the needs of the crew, you know, like for showering and brushing your teeth and cooking. That's an essential thing. So, that's a lot of fresh water that they need every day. I had no idea that it was on that scale. I didn't know it would be that much.
40,000 gallons.
Yeah. Yeah.
Those
and I guess that equipment is what
ones.
The equipment is probably the main take from that, because you can't cool something with salt water. It's just not going to work. It's going to corrode everything. It's going to be a mess. So you need fresh water to be able to do that.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about power supplies?
Yeah, I do, actually. There's I'll mention one here, and then I'll leave one up to you. How about that?
Thanks, buddy.
Diesel engines. A lot of them have diesel engines. And diesel engines are, of course, they need air to operate, so that's that's a problem. They use diesel engines on the surface.
Yeah, it's a catch.
Then when they go underneath, they use electric motors, of course. But really, if you want to think about it this way, submarines are like big hybrid vehicles. They've got these incredible battery packs, arrays that they can use while they're underneath the surface, you know, not only to power the electric motors, but also to power any of the computer systems or, you know, navigation systems that they have on board, everything else, you know, the lighting for the crew, whatever they have on board. So really, you know, it's a diesel-electric hybrid vehicle, really. Mm-hmm. And like I said, it's only used on the surface, but they do have these massive diesel engines. Sometimes they have two of these things on board. And you can imagine that, you know, those take a lot of fuel. So the problem with a diesel-powered submarine is that, you know, you're able to, they're very powerful and they're you know, extremely well built. It's just you have to, you know, either go into port at some point or just you find a refueling station of some kind, you know, whether that's at sea or wherever it is. But you do have a range limitation with them.
Definitely.
So there you go. That should lead right into your next topic very well, shouldn't it?
Oh, man, I owe you one because this is what I want to talk about. The power supply has historically been a big limiting factor for submarines, you know.
Yeah, where are you going to find diesel fuel in the middle of the South Pacific? I mean, I mean, there's islands here and there, but you know, what if you're at war?
Especially if you're sneaking around in a submarine.
Not all that common to find a diesel station out in the middle of the Pacific.
Right. Yeah.
I don't think.
Well, I'm going to go out on a limb and say they don't naturally occur.
Probably not.
Yeah. Someone has to build it. but also, you know, during these missions, the idea of the submarine as a stealth reconnaissance and monitoring vehicle. Means that the further it can go and the longer it can stay out, the more advantageous it is to have one, which is why somebody said, you know, we are losing so much in diesel and so much time, so much effort. If only there was a way, Scott, to build a submarine that ran on nuclear power.
Intriguing.
Which nowadays we already have them, but you have to wonder, would we have agreed to this in this modern age? I don't know.
I don't know.
People aren't big fans of nukes.
I don't know,
now.
But when did this all come about?
Okay, this all happened, I can go to 1954, beginning of 1954. The good old U.S. of A. developed the Nautilus, which was the world's first nuclear-powered submarine. Came with some important differences. It has a practically unlimited range. It can stay underwater for much longer because it doesn't have to surface to start a diesel engine to recharge its electric batteries.
Unlimited range?
Unlimited range, Scott.
Really?
Practically unlimited.
Well, what are you talking about? Like how far?
Like circling the world, circumnavigating the globe four times.
Really?
Stuff like that, yeah. And they don't have to refuel ever. They're designed to – the nuclear reactor there will power it for 25 years without refueling.
25 years?
In theory.
So this thing can go 25 years without without a refuel, a recharge, or whatever you want to call it.
The only drawback at this point, the only reason it's going to the surface is because the crewmen are human.
And they're aging.
And they're aging and they're hungry and they want to see their family.
Like when they went underwater, they're 25 years old, they come up, they're 50.
Oh, God.
No, nothing like that, right?
I hope not.
No, I wouldn't think so. They'd be an awful long mission. Yeah.
And, I mean, we're like...
Wow.
That's got to be... That's a serious vehicle you're doing there. And, you know, I can only imagine what it must be like to be working on a nuclear submarine. But because these things basically have superpowers, they can go forever. They can stay out, you know. They're military might without a curfew, essentially. Mm-hmm. And that sounds pretty good.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
Thanks, man. We worked on that.
Military
earlier.
Might without a curfew.
Yeah, I don't know.
No, I like it.
Yeah, maybe we're in the wrong line of work. Maybe we should sell jingles.
Maybe.
For that. But so because they could go so far for so long, they pretty much changed naval strategy. I won't say entirely, but changed the game. New chapter. Submarines before, Scott, they were just coastal defense. You know, you had to go refuel the diesel.
Sure.
But these can travel the globe. Shortly after their invention, we had a Nautilus reach the North Pole in 1958. Even after that, we still kept them. Now, of course, we still kept them in service. Excuse me. Now, of course, we still have nuclear submarines just because they're so good at what they're designed to do. Mm-hmm. But they also have a nuclear reactor, which means we have had some trouble with those. You know, in the very beginning, a lot of people don't know this, nuclear reactors were just dropped in the ocean when they were done.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. You know, we also have aircraft carriers that are powered by the same devices.
We do.
And it's definitely a military's latched onto this as far as power options.
Mm-hmm.
And with good reason. I mean, apparently it makes complete sense. I mean, imagine having to stop an aircraft carrier to fuel up.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than being able to go 25 years without refueling, that's quite a benefit.
Yeah, and the governments of the world governments at the time definitely recognized it because we saw billions upon billions upon millions, maybe, dollars piled into or poured into submarine research, technology, and fabrication. The heyday of submarines, really, when we start seeing a lot of breakthroughs in heavy building, happens during the Cold War, because the U.S. and the Soviet burgeoning conflict there went across the world. So you can't beat a machine that can take you, whichever side you're on, you can't beat a machine that can take you out there. And so they did deterrence patrols, which is just sort of showing your, making your presence known, you know, hunting other submarines, and then, of course, the very vague special operations, which is for a different podcast.
Sure.
So now we have, where are we now? We got six nations that have nuclear subs. We've got Russia, India, France, China, the United Kingdom, and, of course, our favorite hometown in the globe, the United States.
Very good. Six nations with it, huh?
Six nations. There are some other guys trying to be the new kid on the block. Brazil and Pakistan are working up some ideas.
Really? Okay. Uh-huh. Interesting.
Yeah, and you know, we've got a really great article that I want to recommend on the site for anyone interested, which is, do we still need nuclear submarines?
Oh, good. And I didn't look into that one. I just saw the how subs work and did some other, you know, outside research, but that's an interesting question. You want to give it away? Give me the answer. Okay, podcast.
Okay, maybe after the podcast.
Just tell me the answer.
All right. I'll tell you the answer after the podcast.
Okay, fair enough.
But real quick, though, people are probably saying, hey, you guys are ripping us off. You're glossing over this nuclear reactor and submarine deal. Yeah. Sounds like you just made it up. Can't blame them. It does sound kind of sci-fi.
Yeah, sure.
But a nuclear reactor in these submarines is basically, it's like a steam engine. It's got a casing that weighs 100 tons. It's got an alloy that protects the radiation, or protects the crew members, rather, from the radiation.
Sure, yeah.
And when the heat from this drives the turbine,
sure,
then it powers the vehicle.
But, so it's a steam-powered... It's steam-powered.
Uh-huh, with radiation.
That's unbelievable. So it's a steam-powered underwater... I mean, really, it's running off of steam power, really. Or is that right? No, the nuke is producing
the heat and energy, which produces the steam, which turns the turbine.
Cool.
So, Very cool. Is that a potato thing?
I think so.
Turbine.
Yeah, sure.
I'm just going to Porsche. No, that one guy had me on Porsche. He got me on that.
Yeah.
Okay, so of course these things come armed with a lot of weapons. Polaris ballistic missiles, Tomahawk cruise missiles, Trident missiles, the Poseidon. These have all been on our nuclear subs at some point. The U.S. has four generations of nuclear subs, and we being the U.S., we're using them pretty well, pretty regularly. So you can't buy one.
You can't buy one?
I checked.
Oh, you did? You looked into it?
Cause can't buy one legally.
You know what? You've been pretty excited about this since you started looking up in the information last week, I think, right? You said this is kind of your new favorite vehicle.
Yeah, definitely, man. Between that and aircraft carriers.
And flying cars.
Yes. Scott,
you'd rather have this. Cars. You'd rather have a nuclear sub than a... Yeah, nuclear sub or flying car. Which one would you rather have?
Nuclear sub, absolutely. Really? No contest whatsoever. Yeah.
Sure.
Really? I can't believe you asked. You don't know me
tough
that well.
Tough to park those things.
I wouldn't park it, man. I would just drive around. It never runs out of gas.
You never see anything.
Sure, I would.
Do they even have windows? They got a periscope.
They have...
You could surface,
they
I
have
guess.
Radar imaging.
Walk around on the deck.
I would see all kinds of dots. You know?
Just walk around on the deck and hope it doesn't go under for some reason.
They also receive satellite feeds.
Oh, yeah.
So I probably have cable.
Yeah, maybe something like that. Yeah, cable. No, you wouldn't have cable. Satellite, something.
I could see that, yeah. Maybe not the best vacation spot.
So, okay, a question for you.
Question.
I mean, am I cutting it short here?
No, more? Please.
I got a question. Okay, so I think I know the answer to this one, but would you travel on a nuclear sub? Would you find this a comfortable way to get around? I mean, I know, let's say you're not in the military. Let's just say you're going to take a trip.
Just hanging out?
Yeah, well, just one trip. Let's say you're going to go head down to, I don't know, Australia.
All right.
Would you take a submarine from, you know, the western coast of the United States to, let's say, Australia?
You know, if I, and I'll ask you the same question, I'll ask your opinion too in a second. I would probably not want to. Because,
really?
Yeah, because I'd be in a very crowded situation with a lot of people. It takes a lot of people to run a machine this complex, yeah. You know. It's not like yeah, you and like, me just hopping in.
It's like 40-some people just to keep the thing running, right?
Sure, yeah.
Okay.
And I don't know if I want to do that. Because being on the ocean like that, taking a trip from the States to Australia, part of it is being able to see above the surface. So you know what, man, and I mean this with no disrespect. These are serious machines. These are made, these are not made for people like me to take jaunts.
No, of course not.
In the ocean.
No,
and they're serious people doing.
They're war machines.
Yeah, they're war machines. They're weapons of war.
Yeah.
So
a ship to sink another ship.
Mm-hmm.
Me?
Yeah. What about you?
No.
No.
No, I wouldn't go on one. Now, I'm not terribly claustrophobic. I don't have a problem in elevators or anything like that. Mm. But I think that being underwater for a long period of time like that would probably get to me.
Yeah, I can see that.
I think after a while it would. Right at first I'd be all right, but I think once you start thinking about what's all around you and the pressures involved and just not being able to see where you are at any point and know that you're heading forward at certain speed, and you know I know that they've got very advanced sonar.
Sure,
they're able to tell where they are exactly, but pretty much they're flying blind, aren't they?
I'm sure there are some servicemen who would totally disagree.
No, I know that. I understand.
If everything breaks, then yes,
I understand. You're not looking out a window steering the thing, though. Is
right.
what I'm saying.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean,
right.
there are ways to track where they are exactly. I think the notes I saw say they're accurate within 100 feet,
which is spooky,
pretty That's amazing. Crazy. Because what they do is when they're on the surface, they sync up with GPS, so they know where they are. Then once they submerge, I think it's I'm trying to think of the name of the system. I can't come up with it right now. But there's a system that indicates where they are in the world at that point, and it uses sometimes it uses known. Here it is. It's called inertial guidance systems, which is an electrical mechanical device that it tracks where the ship is via gyroscopes, so it's able to give you the starting point, you know, that's locked in with GPS, and then it detects which direction, which speeds you're heading to tell you where you are on the planet at that point and your depth and depth, of course, is something different, but where you are exactly on the planet. So,
that's so cool.
Yeah, it's amazing. And they said within 100 feet they're able to do this. Now, they have to resync this thing every 150 hours or so. They have to surface and resync so that they know exactly where they are, because after that point it becomes a little bit less accurate. But it's an amazing system. I know that they can navigate very well, but I still would feel a bit uncomfortable doing this.
You know, Scott, I'm sorry, man. I made this podcast run really long because I was so excited about it.
Yeah, a bunch
things.
Of listeners were saying the same thing. I heard them.
Was that who was out
no,
there?
I'm
How
kidding.
Did you guys find the studio?
No, I'm kidding. Yeah. You know what? I thought it was pretty interesting.
I think it's pretty interesting, too. Hopefully, folks who know about our name change from High Speed Stuff to
Car Stuff
will realize that we're still covering motorcycles,
yeah.
Submersibles.
I know. The name, a little bit deceptive in that, you know, it says car stuff. We're not just covering car stuff. It's going to be everything. I mean, we're talking about subs right now. Well, that sounds pretty good, doesn't it? Meatball
sub. I'm kind of hungry. Could
my
you
favorite
hear my
is my favorite is meatball with like a provolone cheese or something like
oh,
that.
Oh, man, we got to get out of here.
So that's perfect.
I'm starving. But as always, we hope you guys enjoyed our overview of the history of submarines, a little bit about how they work and why we still persist in using them. Please check out the website for more information. Check out our Facebook. Check out our Twitter. What am I missing, Scott?
Blog.
Check out our blog. Mm-hmm. And if you would like to write to us, I'd love to hear about somebody who served on submarine.
Yes, because we're doing this all from just, you know, reading, and we've got our own idea of this thing just from what we've picked up, you know, doing some research. But someone who's actually been on board one, I'd love to hear from them.
Yeah, and let's real quick ask our guest producer, Liz Headnot, yes or no, would you go on a submarine? Okay, we got the affirmative. So that's two no's and one yes.
She would, yeah. Okay.
All right, so what about you guys? Tell us what you think. Send us an email at
carstuff@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@howstuffworks.com.